From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Greener, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, we all know honeybees play an important role in pollinating flowers, fruits, and vegetables. And over the past few years, increasing attention has been paid them with respect to their plight as well as protection.
But honeybees aren't the only pollinators buzzing about. Wild native bumblebees also play a vital role in pollinating our fruits and vegetables. There are hundreds of varieties, but one in particular, the rusty-patched bumblebee, has disappeared from approximately 80% of its historic range. This situation finally convinced the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to propose the bee for the endangered species list.
Serena Jepson of the Xerxes Society played a critical role in convincing the Fish and Wildlife Service to make this proposal, and she joins us in the first part of the show to discuss the bee and what an endangered species designation would mean not only to the agricultural industry, but the pollinator industry as well.
Then in the second half of the show, Brian McInerney with the National Weather Service joins us to discuss this past summer's weather and climate. He's got the numbers on just how warm and dry it was, why it occurred, and if those conditions are expected to continue.
The answer is yes.
Never ending.
We don't even need Brian. That's the answer. Yes. We don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Greg, lead designer at Bocholt Landscape Architecture, sponsor on KPCW. Fall and winter are the best seasons to plan and design a project for a spring installation. We can be found at BocholtLandscapeArchitecture.com or at the Reed Building, 649-3856.
I'm on. Did you guys know I'm on?
Hi, I'm Aaron Harmston from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. New this winter, Park City Mountain introduces Epic Mix Time, part of the Epic Mix app that reports on lift line wait times on the mountain. More information on Epic Mix time and other Epic Mix functionality can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak.
That's right.
And joining us for the first half of the show over the phone is Serena Jepson, who runs the Endangered Species Program for the Xerxes Society. Serena, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Nell and Chris.
So let's start with this. Tell us about the Xerxes Society and what it is you do.
Sure. We are a nonprofit organization that protects wildlife through the conservation of invertebrates and their habitats. We were named after the now extinct Xerxes blue butterfly, which is the first butterfly known to go extinct in North America as a result of human activities. So we started out as a society of butterfly scientists, but we now work much more broadly on many different invertebrates, including bees, like the rusty patch bumblebee.
And you're a nonprofit organization. How long have you been around?
We've been around since the early 1970s, so we recently celebrated our 40th anniversary.
Now, not many people tend to focus on the invertebrates out there. Most organizations are focusing on the bigger, charismatic, you know, wildlife and things like that. Is that a challenge for you guys?
A little bit. Certainly, I think that the charismatic megafauna get a lot more attention in the conservation realm, but I also think that this is starting to change. We've seen pollinator conservation especially become much more mainstream in the last few years, partly initiated by the presidential memorandum on pollinators that was announced in 2014, and then the strategy that followed that in 2015. Receiving that kind of federal attention has really shone a light on the challenges that pollinators are facing, and I think engaged a lot of additional federal agencies as well as other conservation organizations in pollinator conservation.
Right, and so like we said in the introduction, honeybees, domesticated honeybees, let's say, are getting a lot more attention these days with respect to their challenges and some efforts to protect them. But the bumblebee, in this case, is also has its own series of challenges, and it plays an important role in our agricultural industry.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, honeybees are absolutely important, critical to U.S. agriculture and definitely the losses that have been seen by beekeepers in the past few decades, a couple of decades at least, have been really troubling. But I think many people don't realize that honeybees are just one species. Mm-hmm. They're not native, and they're a managed species. So the honeybee is absolutely not at risk of extinction. Mm. And the plight of many of our native bees, like the rusty patch bumblebee, is really quite different. It's in critical danger of actually going extinct. I think what many people don't realize is that we have thousands, about 3,500 species of wild bees native to the U.S. And though our honeybee, that one non-native species, is responsible for the majority of pollination of our crops, native bees actually contribute to pollination of crops worth about $9 billion annually. So they are playing a very important role, and it is often overlooked.
Well, today we are focusing, as you mentioned, on the rusty-patched bumblebee. Why the focus on this particular species?
Sure. So this is one of our native bumblebees. We've got, of the 3,500 native bees that we have in North America, we've got about 47 of those are bumblebees. And this is one of our bumblebees that has declined most severely, and it's been really well documented by a number of different researchers. So the rusty patch bumblebee has been lost from about 90% of its historic range in the past 20 years, which is a pretty extensive recent decline. And so the focus has been placed on this bumblebee. And of course, this is the first bumblebee the first bee in the continental U.S. to be placed on the Endangered Species Act list or to be proposed for listing.
Right. Is this bumblebee native to Utah? Can we see it here in Park City?
It is not. It occurs from about eastern North Dakota, Minnesota, all the way east to Maine, and then south through the Appalachian Mountains to northern Georgia. So there are bumblebees native to Utah that are also not doing that well, like the western bumblebee is one example. It's closely related to the rusty patch bumblebee, and it's been a subject of quite a bit of research as well, including by Dr. Jamie Strange at the Logan Bee Lab in Utah, and others documenting the decline in that species. But the rusty patch bumblebee does not occur in Utah.
Give us a quick primer on the difference between a bumblebee and a honeybee.
Sure. Bumblebees tend to be larger. They have a lot of hair on their bodies. They're able to be active in cooler weather and lower light levels than honeybees. Honeybees look sort of honey-colored, and they're, you know, smaller and striped, and they're not covered in these dense, you know, furry hairs the way that bumblebees are. So bumblebees are more of the large-bodied bees that you see visiting flowers.
And do they live in large hives or so, like honeybees?
Yeah. So unlike many of our other native bees, both honeybees and bumblebees have a social structure. So they have a queen and workers that share labor inside the colony. But honeybee colonies tend to be much larger than bumblebee colonies. So honeybees will have colonies in the tens of thousands of individuals, whereas bumblebees will have colonies of maybe a few hundred individuals. Mm. And bumblebees tend to nest underground, perhaps in abandoned rodent burrows, or some species will nest like under tussocks of grass, and even in like tree cavities. Or now we see, you know, certain species of bumblebees nesting like in bird houses. But the rusty patch bumblebee, what we know about that species is that it tends to nest underground.
Wow. Hmm. So tell us about this process that you have been going through for several years now to try to get this species proposed for listing.
Sure. So in 2012, I wrote a petition in collaboration with a couple of other researchers and some other conservation biologists at the Xerces Society to ask that the rusty patch bumblebee be listed under the Endangered Species Act. And we filed that petition in early 2013. A year later, we filed a lawsuit in 2014 with representation from Natural Resources Defense Council lawyers, and reached a settlement agreement with the Fish and Wildlife Service that they would consider our petition and set some timelines for that. So according to that settlement agreement, they needed to do a first review of our petition by September 30th, 2015, which they did. And at that point, they concluded that the petition presented sufficient information to warrant that a further review would be necessary. And then they just, this September, completed their what's called a 12-month finding, their further review of the petition, and they concluded that yes, it does warrant Endangered Species Act listing, and they proposed the species for listing. So now they've opened a 60-day comment period, at which point anyone can submit a comment regarding this species, its population status, the impact of a listing to the Federal Register. And within a year, they we'll consider those comments and hopefully add the species officially to the list.
And how is there a website we can go to provide comments?
Sure. Just go to the Federal Register. I believe it's federalregister.gov.
Okay. And start, I'm assuming, start there.
Yeah, start
not
there.
Not on their front page. Okay. All right.
Yeah. And then you'd have to, I think you'd have to type in Rusty Patched Bumblebee
right
into the search area to submit comments, certainly.
Okay.
Now are there many other insects on, you know, listed as an endangered species?
Yeah.
There are some other insects. There are last year some Hawaiian yellow-faced bees that we've also been working on. Native to the Hawaiian Islands, were proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act. So those are the only other bees that have been proposed for listing. But there are a number of butterflies currently on the Endangered Species Act list, as well as some other species, some beetles and some other species of invertebrates, certainly.
We're speaking with Serena Jepson. She's with the Xerxes Society, and she was one of the authors of the documentation associated with convincing the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to propose this rusty patch bumblebee as an endangered species. I want to loop back. When was it first noticed that this bumblebee's population and range was declining? Because you say in some of our background information that this used to be present in over 28 states as well as parts of Canada, but now they're found what the agency estimates to be approximately 12 states and just a single province in Canada. When were you first kind of detecting a loss of range in population?
Sure. So the first person to really call attention to bumblebee declines across North America was Dr. Robin Thorpe, who's a professor emeritus at UC Davis. And he's been studying bumblebees in the western U.S. for many, many years, and he noticed some declines in closely related species to the rusty-patched bumblebee, both Franklin's bumblebee and the western bumblebee. And he really brought this issue to the attention of the research and conservation community, or at least the bee research and bee conservation community, in the late 1990s. Since that time, many people have been looking more closely and more clearly documenting the extent of range loss and declines in abundance or relative abundance of this species. Since about the late 1990s.
Wow. And so does citizen science play a role in this, too, in helping gather that information?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked. The Xerxes Society, in collaboration with some partners, a few years ago launched a program called Bumblebee Watch. And that's an online platform where people can take a photo of a bumblebee and submit it to this website, bumblebeewatch.org. And then once the photo is submitted, a network of expert bumblebee researchers can verify the identity of that bumblebee. So if you're someone uploading a photo, you can go through an online identification guide and say, okay, I think it's the black-tailed bumblebee. And then you'll submit that photo, and the experts will verify that. And then once your photo is verified, it will go into a database that researchers can use. And we've already used Bumblebee Watch to much better understand the current distribution of the rusty patch bumblebee and to help prioritize where to best target conservation efforts. So it's been an incredibly useful platform to engage, to really crowdsource this information. Mm-hmm. Because with a species as at least historically broadly distributed in, as the rusty patch bumblebee, we really need an army of people out there looking to note where it's found. And citizen science, I think, is really one of the best approaches to do that because of the, you know, just sheer number of boots on the ground,
right,
and eyes that we need to see where it currently occurs.
So you mentioned that the citizen science helps you target conservation efforts. What mm-hmm. kinds of efforts are those? What does conservation, you know, targeted conservation of, for example, the rusty patch bumblebee look like?
Yeah, well, at this point, because until last week, the rusty patch bumblebee, you know, didn't have any sort of status officially. At this point, those efforts have involved reaching out to landowners who harbor rusty patch bumblebees on their property, or you know, maybe there's a nature preserve really close to where someone has seen the rusty patch bumblebee in their backyard. So we have a set of bumblebee conservation guidelines for land managers, and at this point it's just been reaching out, letting them know, you know, we think that they have this really rare species on their property, here's why we care, and offering resources, saying here's what we recommend in terms of various management activities and various things you could do to protect the species if you're interested in it. And we've actually had a huge amount of, you know, proactive interest in bumblebee conservation from those efforts, and we've used the citizen science information to lead us to the, you know, the people that are actually managing this species.
So with all of this in mind, what, you know, what comes next with the listing? Right now they're proposed,
right,
to be added to the endangered species list.
Right. So we expect the Fish and Wildlife Service to finalize that proposed listing and designate critical habitat within 1 year. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is accepting comments until November 21st of this year. And then in the next year, we expect them to finalize that proposed listing. And then at that point, once the species added to the list, it will receive protection from the adverse effects of various activities. And there will be restrictions on what's called take of the rusty patch bumblebee, so any sort of activity that could kill or harm the species.
Yeah, but that could include pesticides and herbicides and fungicide applications by the agricultural industry, right?
Certainly, within the area where it occurs. And the Fish and Wildlife Service recognized that in their finding that once the species is listed, certain activities like perhaps applying pesticides that are known to be really harmful to bumblebees may become illegal unless an incidental take permit is obtained from Fish and Wildlife Service.
Wow. Well, do other agencies have a chance? Obviously, other agencies will have a chance to comment during this mm-hmm. comment period, and that's when
yes.
they're going to be part of, because the EPA is going to log in, the Department of Agriculture is going to kind of log in their views and opinions on this. Department of Commerce, everybody's going to have an opinion on it. Because this bee is not just about a bee. This is about pollinator species writ large, too, in a way.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that the species, the reason for the species decline initially was probably due to diseases from managed bumblebees. And there's a fair amount of evidence to support that notion.
Bumblebees.
So there's
yeah.
managed bumblebees.
But
yeah.
since that time, you know, now that the populations are much smaller, I think some major threats to the species include primarily pesticides used within right. its range. So, you know, currently the species occurs primarily in the upper Midwest, which is really a key agricultural area in the U.S. and an area of high corn and soy and even wheat production.
Right.
Areas where a lot of pesticides are used and actually a lot of neonicotinoids are used, which is, you know, now the most widely used pesticide,
right.
used heavily on corn and soy, and really, really damaging to bees and bumblebees.
Right. You know, like we said, this isn't just about one bumblebee. This is about the mm-hmm. bumblebee community and bee community and pollinator mm-hmm. community at large.
Certainly, and certainly if restrictions are placed on neonicotinoids used in rusty patch bumblebees range, they will benefit not only the rusty patch bumblebee, but other pollinators in general within those areas.
Okay. So I have to follow up on a comment that you made. Chris and I both looked at each other and thought, this is interesting. You mentioned managed bumblebees. We always talk about managed honeybees. What are bumblebees being managed for?
Right. So bumblebees are managed for commercial pollination. And this is actually a relatively new industry. It wasn't until the late 1990s that people even, or maybe the mid-1990s, that people really understood how to commercially produce colonies of bumblebees. There were some advances in research that allowed this to happen, and there are a number of crops that benefit from bumblebee pollination. So greenhouse tomatoes, for example, greatly benefit from bumblebee pollination, and they are a plant that can't be pollinated by honeybees. Honeybees are not able to get pollen from tomato flowers. And there are many other crops as well that utilize commercial bumblebees, but this is a largely unregulated industry. So there's absolutely no requirement in the U.S. that bumblebees that are bought and sold and moved around be free of diseases. And there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that diseases from managed bumblebees increased when they were in captivity, and then when they were, brought out to farms for pollination, those pathogens then spread to wild bumblebees and led to their decline. And this is a hypothesis, again, developed by Dr. Robin Thorpe out of UC Davis, and it's been tested extensively by Dr. Sidney Cameron from the University of Illinois, as well as by Dr. Jamie Strange from the Logan Bee Lab.
So if I want to be a backyard champion of bumblebees, I can the same plants or vegetations that attract honeybees will also attract bumblebees?
For the most part, Okay. Sure. There are certain plants that are more effectively pollinated by bumblebees, and part of the reason for that is that bumblebees have this really neat behavior called buzz pollination, and that's where they actually detach their wings from their flight muscles and then vibrate their flight muscles as if they were flying. But it causes their body to vibrate instead at a really high speed, and that causes some kinds of flowers to release their pollen.
Whoa.
So some flowers require that type of pollination. Other flowers just benefit from it. But that's not something that honeybees can do. So I believe about 8% of our flowers benefit from buzz pollination, and there's really just a few kinds of bees that can do that, bumblebees being chief among them.
Wow. All right. I'm a newfound fan. Love honeybees. Now I'm just going to add bumblebees to that list because they're pretty amazing too.
If you have tomatoes in your garden, you can actually hear bumblebees. You can watch them visit and you can actually hear them buzz pollinating the tomatoes.
Okay.
All right. On the list for next season.
It's on the list.
Yeah.
Along with a couple other things we have to wrap up. Serena, Bumblebee Watch. How do kids take photos of bumblebees and submit
adults.
Them? And yes, adults.
And submit them. And you can take a photo on your phone and upload it. It's bumblebeewatch.org. You have to create an account, and then you should be set to go.
And you're a real scientist after that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
You can also take our pledge to bring back the pollinators, which is essentially committing to managing your yard in a way that benefits bees, recognizing that they need food resources, so planting flowers that bloom from early spring to late fall so that there aren't, gaps in nectar and pollen for the bees throughout the season, recognizing they need a safe place to nest, and committing to not using pesticides on your garden.
Fantastic, and that can all be found on your website?
Yes.
Which is?
Yes.
Xerces, which is xerces.org.
Fantastic. Well, Serena Jepson, thank you so much for joining us this morning to talk about
rusty
patch bumblebee.
Yeah, thanks, Serena.
It.
All right. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service joins us to give us an update on this past summer's weather and climate. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Support for KPCW comes from Rocky Mountain Power, introducing Subscriber Solar, bringing homes and businesses solar power from a solar farm, no rooftop required. More at utahsolarworks.com.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over three-fourths of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Hi, this is Molly from Recycle Utah. Please join us for our 7th Annual Harvest Fest on Saturday, October 1st from noon to 5 p.m. at the High Star Ranch in Camas. This free festival highlights the best of Summit County with local food, beer, live music, activities for kids, handmade goods, and of course, the famous Rotary apple pies. Come join us.
Recycle Utah is your local nonprofit recycling drop-off center, bringing water conservation ideas to you for now 25 years, and we support KPCW.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. And now bumblebees. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in the studio, the second part of the show, is Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist at the National Weather Service down at in Salt Lake City. Brian's here every quarter to give us an update. In this case, how our summer went.
Yeah,
temperature and precipitation wise, and we're going to take a wild guess. It was hot and it was dry. How's that
captured?
That's
about it right there.
We're
really?
Done.
All right.
Yeah, we're done.
Can you fill us in on some specifics? How hot was it this summer?
We broke 17 heat records down in the Salt Lake City airport.
17?
17. Whoa. 14 of which were nighttime lows that were, for the day, were the highest we've seen since 1874. We broke the hottest nighttime low ever. That was 81 degrees, meaning it should get much cooler than that during the nighttime hours, and it only got down to 81. That was a record. We had 21 days of 95 degrees or above straight during the summer months. Yeah, so for 21 straight days, it was 95 degrees or above.
Okay.
And we've never seen that before.
Right. And that's it. Let's stop there because typically, you know, it's the 100-degree days that get all the attention.
Yeah.
In this case, there were probably maybe a few 100-degree days amongst that.
Yeah.
But it's the duration now of the above-average warmth that's really starting to set in.
Yeah.
In this case, 21 straight days.
Yeah, 21 straight days. So it was pretty miserable during that time frame. It was the hottest June ever experienced.
And I thought that was 2013 or 2014 or 2015.
We just keep breaking these records one after another. When you look globally, we've had 16 months in a row of record temperatures. Every month has been hotter than what you've ever seen before. So.
And actually, August was not only the hottest August on record, it was the hottest month ever recorded.
Yeah, globally.
Globally.
Yeah.
All right, and it just like you say, it's 60 months, so it's looped back around on itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you mentioned 14 of those 17 records were nighttime heat records, one of which is the highest low of 81. What are these others?
Just daytime highs, the hottest it's ever been for that day. You know, the maximum temperature for that day.
For that day, okay.
Yeah.
And but 14 out of, let's say, 90 days, right, the three-month period. That's roughly 15-16% of the summer.
Yeah.
Nighttime lows were broken.
Yeah, it was fourth hottest July ever. So when you rank that, we had a trace of precipitation in July, and that was a record. You know, when you think of a trace, that's the only precip we had during that time.
So the total month, a trace means what, less than a tenth of an inch or something?
No, like, it's you can't even measure it. It's so small. It's like the bucket got a little damp, and so they call it a trace. It's a hundredth would be the next step up.
So it was less than a hundredth
of an
inch. And that happened sometime in July. I think it was the beginning, near the beginning of the month, I'm not, because I remember.
Yeah.
And then was August also, wasn't August pretty dry?
We were dry, but we weren't record dry. We had a few storms here and there. We had 30 flash flood warnings as of just the other day when we had all this wild weather. And typically we get 80 to 100 is a kind of an average year. And some of the bigger years we go up to 120 and we only had 30. So there wasn't any moisture to speak of. In Utah, we really didn't have much of a monsoonal flow. So when you think of the lack of rain and the amount of temperature rises that we've had, it was a very hot, very dry summer and a lot of high pressure. And another byproduct of all this heat and low flows from the runoff and lack of rain and lack of wind was the algal blooms that we've seen in some of the water bodies.
Yes, we talked about that in Utah Lake.
And Schofield Reservoir, and there's been others in Idaho, which are a little unsettling, especially Schofield Reservoir, because you think, well, it's due to the runoff from all the farm fields, all the nitrogen and sulfur fertilizers. But Schofield Reservoir is a high mountain reservoir. It doesn't have the inflow from agricultural fields. So this is a little unsettling because it's bacteria that gets in your water supply.
Right.
And if we start seeing this as, you know, if we warm again next year, the question is, will we see more of these algal blooms and more of these bacterial flows in the water supply? And that's what Schofield is. It's a water supply. So that was a little unsettling, I thought. And then follow that up with 2 days of wild weather where we had widespread flooding from Zion National Park across the south and then up the east part of Utah all the way into Duchesne. Every waterway was in flood. We had slot canyons, dry washes, small streams, larger rivers were all in flood because of rainfall amounts. The town of Sunnyside had 4.98 inches during the event, which was roughly a 48-hour event, and they get maybe 8 inches annually. So,
so these are these one in 100 year events or something along those lines? Can you measure that?
Yeah, you can. We haven't. We were just overwhelmed with weather that day. We had
this is last week.
Yeah, this was last week. We had two tornadoes touchdown. We had widespread flooding. We had straight line winds from thunderstorms that were quite damaging across the Wasatch Front.
80, 90 mile an hour winds. I heard maybe even above that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And 101 miles per hour on top of Ogden Peak.
Wow.
And so when you look at this event, it was ferocious. And it caused I do the flooding aspect of it. When the event was working, I was issuing flood warnings and such. But the meteorologists are doing severe thunderstorm warnings and trying to get a handle on where the winds are going to go in what direction. And when it was all said and done, the damage was incredible, what you saw, you know, power outages and buildings damage. And then we go right back into high pressure again, you know, and it's kind of nice weather again.
So what were the conditions that, like, set that storm up and caused things like tornadoes to happen in Utah? So
when you have a big thunderstorm like this, you have rotation that starts on the outflow winds as the genesis of the thunderstorm is moving across the valley. Winds are being pulled in, and then there's updrafts. And then there starts to be a rotation at the ground. Think of a pencil between your two hands as you're rolling your hands. The pencil is rotating. And that's on the surface. And eventually that starts to rise as that updraft pulls into the thunderstorm, and you get a tornado. And tornadoes are very rare in Utah. If we do get them, they're very small, F0, F1 on the enhanced Fujita scale. And to have two in the same storm was incredibly rare during this time. When you look at the thunderstorms, it was a moisture-laden system that just intensified as it came across the desert from Nevada. And when you look down into southern Utah, we had rain amounts of 1 to 2 inches widespread. And that area can't take that much rain. So Zion National Park went from, on the North Fork, which is a very popular hike. People walk in, they call it the Narrows. Mm-hmm. You actually walk in the river. They close it at about 140 cubic feet per second flow. It went up to 2,000 CFS in about a three-hour window.
From 100 to 2,000 CFS in that short period. Anybody get down on video?
I would think so with today's society. Yeah. I would think somebody has it on video.
No one was harmed?
Nobody was harmed.
So the warnings went out?
Yeah, warnings
were out. People abided by them?
Well done.
And that's a part of your success story you're seeing now with your relationship between the Weather Service and the Park Service and coordinating information like that?
We're trying to we've been working with the parks just because these events occur. So they know who the Weather Service is. They don't think it's a TV guy who's going to give them a daily weather report. They know we're going to alert them for thunderstorms and heavy rain and flooding. And it's getting more difficult. It's getting more extreme out of nowhere, where you have these long periods of very dry weather, and then suddenly you have this massive event that rolls in and creates havoc for people who are down there. There was cars stuck. There were people stranded, but luckily nobody died. If you look a year ago at this time, September 14th, 21 people died from a single thunderstorm complex that moved up through the town of Colorado City in Hilldale. And then that very same thunderstorm moved up into Zion National Park. And then when it was all said and done, there was 21 people that were killed. So the fact that nobody died during this storm was really nice to hear.
That's great. Like I said, it's a success story there. But, you know, for years you've been coming on this show and talking about how one of the elements of climate change is the intensity of storms that we're going to see, the changing intensity, more intense storms. And this we might be able to say that this is an example of that intensity, right?
Yeah. If you look at the science, this is what the climate scientists indicate. Storms will become less frequent and more intense. And we're seeing that in our northwest flow for the wintertime storms coming off of Alaska, the lows that move in and provide snow for water supply and skiing. Those are less frequent but more intense. And this is a good example of what we can see more of with these incredible deluges and then interspersed with periods of long, hot, dry weather. And we will see more of this as we continue to warm our atmosphere. And it's frightening because our society is not geared for these types of events. We have more people living next to streams. We've built next to dry washes.
Right.
And our job is a moving target now to try and warn for these intense events.
We're speaking with Brian McInerney. He's the senior hydrologist of the National Weather Service down in Salt Lake City, getting an update on this past summer's weather and climate, et cetera. Looping back to the summer, and the National Weather Service considers summer June, July, and August, right?
Yeah, call that the meteorological summer.
Meteorological summer, one of the warmest and one of the driest on record. Why was that? Is this still a remnant of El Nino or other conditions?
El Nino is no more. The warming in the equatorial Pacific basically went back to neutral conditions roughly in late spring.
Okay.
Now we're headed to a weak La Nina, meaning it's going to be cooler than normal in the equatorial Pacific, but only a little bit. It's kind of a variation. So people ask, what's the winter going to look like? Are we going to be stormy?
Right.
And when you have a weak La Nina, that's what climate scientists use or scientists that forecast weather beyond 7 days. They indicate that there's not much skill. Because if it's that strong El Nino we had last year that was record-breaking, you could put your finger on that and say, typically when that happens, you get desert Southwest becomes wetter and cooler, Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest becomes warmer and drier. And we were very excited. This is a change. This is something different. It'll change that high pressure that stagnates out over the Pacific, and hopefully we'll have a really big winter. And mm-hmm. it was working out pretty well. I mean, it didn't behave like it typically should, but it was very dynamic weather pattern. And then at the end of January, the high pressure set in and put a clamp on all of the weather moving our way. And when you think of the skiing in December and January, it was fabulous. And then February hit. And then it shut off, and we had another below-average year. So that's 5 years in a row of below-average runoff. This will be number 6 if we go below. But usually we don't go longer than 4 to 5 in the most recent history of any wet cycle or dry cycle. 2000 to 2004 was the last dry cycle consecutive years that we had. Now we've been in it since 2012. So 2012, 2013, 14, 15, 16. Now we're moving into the water year 2017 on October 1st, and hopefully something will shift. But the ridge, the high-pressure ridge that blocks our weather, is being studied. Stanford University has called it the ridiculously resilient ridge. And they're doing analysis on why this high pressure has set up, and it's an intensified, and it's not moving. It's anomalous. It should shift. It should change. It should get smaller, move out over the Pacific, something. But it's not. And it's getting bigger, and it deflects all of the weather up into Alaska and Canada, and we get high pressure, sunny skies, inverted air masses, pollution in the valleys, more of what we see during the cold season. So hopefully the ridge won't set up early in October and November, block and stay there. But it's really been the dominant weather feature since the fall of 2011.
It's interesting to hear that it's so notable that now universities are starting to take notice and do research on this as a total anomaly.
Yeah. I mean, this is Stanford University. They do really good work, and they're analyzing the magnitude of this high pressure and why it's been so stagnant. And they are trying to come up with reasons why, and they're still working on it.
Dare I say also part of the shifting normalities, perhaps?
Yeah. I mean, that has come up. It's a warmer atmosphere, so the weather's becoming more enhanced. We're seeing a different norm, and this may be something we'll see in the future on a regular basis. Hopefully not.
This is interesting. A few weeks ago, there's hurricanes spinning off the coast of Mexico, and occasionally they head north versus heading west, and there was a tropical system that came up far enough north that that was impacting Arizona and New Mexico. In the future, might we see part of this shifting normality, larger tropical systems off the coast of Mexico that also head north? Might we see more influence from tropical systems?
Maybe. I think the idea is that now we're into a warmer atmosphere, the idea that the atmosphere can hold more energy, but that also has winds at higher levels that shear off the top of those hurricanes. So you may not, or you may, depending. And I think it's, like we said earlier, it's kind of a moving target, whether we'll see. But the idea is the Atlantic hurricanes, that can hold more energy, and they worry about that. But there's some parts to that that could totally derail the hurricane features, and it's kind of out of my league, truthfully.
Right.
But that's what I've heard when you talk to the people who do this research. They're trying to figure this out, but the atmosphere can hold more energy.
Right. A warmer atmosphere is a more humid atmosphere, or at least has the potential to hold more
moisture.
Okay.
And that's the reason why we're getting more intense rain events, and also they're interspersed with longer periods of high pressure.
Okay.
Well, with all of the weather discussion in mind, how are the reservoir levels looking? How's our water storage?
You know, when you look at 5 years of below average runoff, they're not doing too bad comparatively. They're not great. If you drive past Echo, it's kind of wild to see how low it is, or Rockport, or any of those systems. Uh-huh. But we're at the end of the water year. It could be a lot worse, but what happened was the water shares that go to the farmers were cut by 50%, and some didn't get any water shares because the inflow was so low. They have certain – if the inflow is this amount, then you will get this amount. And when you look at the reservoirs, they're not good. But if we just used as business as usual, or the water districts didn't cut the water to some of the farmers, they would be really in bad shape. But overall, they're 5, maybe 10% below where they were last year. And they weren't great last year, but we're still below. So what we need is to start this water year right now with a lot of rainfall, and we're not seeing that. The soils are so incredibly dry from this dry summer that the idea is once we put snow on it and then we melt it, it's going to infiltrate like a dry sponge. Mm-hmm. If we could somehow turn the weather around and put together a series of maybe 3 weeks of a lot of rain, a lot of storminess on a regular basis, we could take away some of that pore space and put water in it and then put snow on it. When it melts, it'll go onto a wet sponge and then run off into the streams and into the reservoirs.
Right.
So we're starting water year 2017 behind the eight ball with very dry soils and a lack of weather. We had a two-day weather system that was quite wild, but yet we're back to sunny skies and blue skies.
And an example of a sponge might be Swanner's system, your wetland system.
My personal wetland system.
That's your wetland.
So, well, when you were talking about those dry soils, it's something we were thinking about even this summer because we were concerned about the level of East Cannon Creek. It was in danger of drying up. It was super low. We got a few of those small rain events. And because the soil was so dry, it hardly even impacted flow. Like that water did not make it into the streams that would take it to the reservoirs. It was just getting sucked right up by that dry sponge, like Brian said.
You got to fill the sponge first.
Yeah.
And then you generate runoff from there.
Exactly.
Okay. So last week's storm, pretty intense, but dare I say it, drop in the bucket with respect to what we really need coming forward. And Great Salt Lake is that's one of its lowest levels too, isn't it?
Yeah. And in Great Salt Lake, it's the majority of its inflow from Bear River. And Bear River has been low every year. This year, the headwaters actually were normal to right around normal. The flows coming out of the mountains in the Uintas on the north aspect were right, what you would consider average. But the usage is so great as it goes downstream. It's diverted into farm fields that by the time it gets to the Great Salt Lake, even an average runoff at the headwaters turns into a much below average runoff into the Great Salt Lake. And it's at one of its lowest levels that we've seen since we've been recording this. And that's going to take many years, if at all, depending on the usage upstream. But that's the grim reality of the Great Salt Lake. And when you think of the Great Salt Lake declining its volume, you bring up a myriad of all these other problems where you have this briny soil that if you have wind events, it kicks up a lot of that dust and blows it into the Salt Lake City area, which is unhealthy for the people living there. So there's all these different things that will happen.
It influences habitat. Duck migration and such. They may not spend as much time there. There's not as much food for them to feed on or protected areas.
Interestingly, access from predators to areas that were previously islands has been a big
impact. They have access. Okay.
Yeah.
So everything changes in that sense with a lower salt lake. Okay. So everything's in play. So, okay, Brian, couple of minutes. We've got to do it. What's the forecast for the next 2 days? You can do that one, right? We have a system coming in.
Yeah.
A little one.
Yeah, a little one.
But not much.
That's okay. A little one's better than nothing.
We'll take it,
right? The long-range forecast, though, there really isn't one beyond 7 days.
Don't you guys read the Farmer's Almanac?
Let's not talk about
that. Okay.
It's unknown beyond 7 days. It'd be nice if we knew what was ahead of us, but that's just the nature of weather forecasting. 7 days is your limit for any reliable weather forecast. Truthfully, it's about 5 days. We look at 7 days as an idea what's out there. 5 days, you can get a pretty good feel if the models all agree. But beyond 7 days, the process falls apart.
So if somebody's trying to tell you what's going to happen, don't believe them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And that's what we do here. We stick to 2 days. So today it's sunny and tomorrow it looks a little cloudy. And that's about it.
That's about it.
Thursday it might rain. I'm not going any beyond that. See us tomorrow for Thursday's weather.
Yeah.
Okay. Brian McInerney, Senior Hydrologist with the National Weather Service. As always, thanks so much for the information. Of course, plug your website.
Weather.gov. Click on wherever you want to go in the U.S. You can get a forecast for a really small area.
You're highly granular that
That's
way.
That's right.
Thanks, Brian.
That's right.
I like that. The point forecast.
All right. Let's take a break for underwriting. When we come back, we got one nice little item to touch on.
Yeah.
Local phenomena?
Yes.
Spiders.
Interesting phenomena.
Spiders floating about. It's this green earth. Stay tuned.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth.
Rocky Mountain Power offers WattSmart advice, such as avoiding the use of large appliances like a washer or dryer between 2 and 8 p.m. It helps reduce energy demand and keeps costs down for all of us. More ways to save energy at WattSmart.com.
This is Renee from the Sprinkler Barn at Park City Nursery, blowing through another season with KPCW. Sprinkler winterizations are available online through the end of October. The nursery also carries a variety of fall products, including wildflower seed, fertilizers, composts, spring bulbs, and more. We know what grows at ParkCityNursery.com.
This is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We are committed to serving Park City and are proud supporters of KPCW. More information at bhhsutah.com or one of our 24 offices throughout Summit and Wasatch counties.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got just a couple minutes for share an interesting phenomenon that's going on here in Park City area. I'm sure all across the county.
Yeah. Country, actually.
You think
maybe
so?
Not at the
maybe
same
not,
time,
but
yeah.
Okay, you can see it here,
right?
And the last couple of days, I've noticed it. It happens in the middle of the afternoon when there's not so much wind. It's a little less windy in the afternoons, and it's warm, and it creates thermals. And so what happens is, with respect to there's some spiders in the area, right?
Yeah.
These spiders are trying to. How would you say it? Migrate, or they're trying to?
Yeah, they're trying to migrate.
Okay.
Disperse. Of the young spiders dispersing.
Right. So they climb to the top of a tree. They kind of point themselves in their abdomen up.
Yep.
And they shoot out a really long length of silk, and the wind and the warm air catches that in such a way that it lifts them off the tree. And if you look at the sun kind of shield yourself in the right way, you can see these long reflections of this silk webbing floating about in the sky in the afternoon. And I mean long, feet and feet long, and I mean hundreds of feet up into the air. It's amazing.
So the journeys that these spiders have taken have been documented from a few meters to hundreds of kilometers, and even atmospheric data that have collected samples of balloons, which is what this is called, ballooning or kiting, at 5 kilometers above the Earth.
Five.
And ships in mid-ocean have reported spider landings. So, these are going like
so
incredible.
So once they
places.
Get caught up in the thermals, mm-hmm. they're
yeah.
going.
Places. It is dangerous. Mortality is high, but
– yes.
It does the
Most
job,
of them
apparently.
Probably don't travel more than a few feet and fail. But
right.
those fortunate get sent out. And you can see it in the afternoons here in Park City. So
check it out this afternoon.
So if you're a bit of arachnophobe,
or
you
not.
Probably didn't want to hear this news. All right. We just we're full disclosure on the science.
Yeah, we should have given the disclaimer before we did the
yeah,
piece.
Yeah, if you didn't want to.
Next
all right.
time.
Hey, we got to take one more underwriter break. We'll come back to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hey, it's time to wrap things up here on This Green Earth. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make this show possible. They include
Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Bacholt Landscape Architects,
Rocky Mountain Power,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
and Park City Mountain.
That's right. You can join us and maybe even like us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
If we're lucky.
Yes.
And also email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Hey, thanks again. Real quick, to Serena Jepson with the Xerxes Society. Go out and take some photos of bumblebees and submit them to bumblebeewatch.org. Do your part in citizen scientry.
That's right. This is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again. We'll see you next week.